This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Find out if the opening of the new Portillo's in Normal is a big deal. It is online and in social media.
It was the 10th most popular post in terms of engagement on their page ever. The only location that we saw that was bigger was a restaurant in Tampa Bay, Florida.
Ryan Denham talks with Nate Carpenter from ISU's Social Media Analytics Command Center. Portillo's opens today. Discover if a 10th century German emperor has any resonance today. Charlie Schlenker talks with an ISU history professor and author of a new biography of Frederick Barbarossa. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio to talk about a trip to Japan, the Downtown Bloomington Association, and a proposed assistant. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's August 15th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council appointed members of a new transportation commission, discussed making the Downtown Bloomington Association part of city government, talked about a full-time mayoral assistant, and approved new signage on the back of Connect Transit buses. In the studio to talk about some of that and a recent trip to Japan is Mayor Terry Renner. Terry, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I want to ask about some recent exchanges you've had on a right-leaning blog about your trip to Asayakawa, Japan. But first, let's talk about the Sister Cities program. Why is it important?
Well, Sister Cities program is 55 years old. It's critical in terms of educational, cultural exchanges, economic exchanges, and essentially every year we have students who come here from Asakawa, and every year we have students that go to Asakawa. And that usually those are junior high students, somewhere around 15 years old, because they want to be old enough to be able to do this and go through the experience. And every year, about 35 students come here, and I host them in City Hall. I not only show them my office, I show them, you know, how we vote in our council chambers. So there's definitely some important educational, cultural components to the exchange. And there have been some economic changes. Some have suggested one of the reasons why we got Mitsubishi in the first place is because we had a sister city arrangement with Asakawa. The other thing I can say is the people in Asakawa were so gracious. And it's, of course, they also know that it takes you 2 days basically to get there and 2 days to get back, and you're only there for 4.5 days. So they make sure we were busy, but they were very gracious.
So a cultural and economic exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we had people meet with members of their vice principals and principals to try to figure out ways that we can even increase those educational exchanges. When they put it, we were there for their 50th anniversary of their zoo. And when they put their zoo in, we had a 5-year arrangement, and we were very, very helpful for them in terms of putting in their first zoo.
So 55 years this year.
55 years. And just to clarify, it's every 5 years they come here and we host them, and every 5 years we go there and host them. So this is about an every decade trip. Chris Coos has been there once, and he was there 10 years ago. And then I actually got a humanitarian aid award this time. Coos got it 10 years ago, but you can't get it more than once. So that's why I got it and he didn't.
So how much did it cost the city of Bloomington? And obviously you think it's worth the cost.
Yeah, well, and that's really difficult to say because much of this, most people fund their own. In fact, the city's sister cities, I believe the only ticket that the sister cities committee, the delegation that was paid for by the city of Bloomington was my ticket. And I think the only ticket in Normal was Chris Coos's. And so there are also money from State Farm and local businesses and others, philanthropic organizations. So I think that this is it. This is the first time in two generations where anyone has tried to raise any kinds of questions.
And that's my question. Why do you think this program is now coming under attack after decades of non-controversy and the community actively embracing it and promoting it?
Again, we've had I don't know why. I do know that we have a very small group of very noisy people who are really against everything since the invention of the wheel. And so this is really the first time that we've seen anything here. And this is just part of our city government, where a very small group of people are just occupying a large portion of our staff and legal time trying to throw bombs at just about everything.
So let's talk about your significant other's ticket. I understand the city of Bloomington's legal opinion is that the city could have just simply paid for her ticket. She did reimburse the city. What's the issue?
There is no issue, and that's the point. People bring up issues and have, brag about filing complaints with the state police. Well, you can file complaints with state police about just about anything. And that's what's exhausting after a while. And from my perspective, there is always the question of, okay, why would you respond? Well, 99.9999% of the time, I don't bother to respond. When it involves somebody that you care about, it's a little harder, and especially when it's been time after time after time about this. Like, one of the people that I responded to, Bruce Meeks, is not just somebody who constantly FOIA stuff. It's somebody who I had to nearly get a restraining order on during the last campaign, who challenged my petitions over nothing, who's just constantly costing, frankly, me and the taxpayers money.
What would have been the grounds of that restraining order?
Because he was in two debates at cities, he was right in my face, and there were campaign workers, fortunately, who, and I'm not going to hit him, but that's probably what he was looking for.
So you think he was being provocative?
Oh, he was being more than provocative. He was absolutely in my face, yelling at me. Within about 2 inches.
So this right leaning blog that
I don't think it's right leaning. I would say you can be, like, my father was a conservative Republican. I think you can be a conservative Republican. These people aren't conservative Republicans.
So how would you describe the blog that we're not naming?
Fanatics.
Okay.
Regardless of ideology. There are left-wing, right-wing fanatics,
sure,
as well.
So the person behind this blog on July 31st, you threatened to sue her. Why?
Because essentially she was saying things that were absolutely, totally untrue. And also, it wasn't so much mine. The attorney that handled my petitions is the one who said that, you really should take legal action. I said, yeah, but I'm a political figure. This is hard. But when you actually go after someone who's a private citizen, that's where there's a lower legal threshold.
Are you going to sue her?
At this point, because there's so much attention over nothing, I doubt it.
So,
somebody needs to draw the line here. This is the kind of nasty, vicious political stuff that we have.
Do they have to draw a line, or could both sides just walk away?
Well, one side is not going to walk away. I mean, we're talking about the equivalent of rabid attack dogs who are not going to go away. And I don't know what the answer is.
So
probably suing would probably put a smile on their face, yeah, because they could be on the front page of the Pantograph, or we'd be talking about them like we are right now. And they're largely irrelevant to anything except that they cost the city taxpayers a lot of money.
So just this week, you sent an email to one of the blog supporters. You mentioned him by name, Bruce Meeks. That email was sent at 2:46 in the morning in response to a suggestion that you self-report the spending on the trip to Japan to the state police. That sort of sounds like what we're getting from the White House, those sorts of late night, emails and tweets.
Essentially, after getting back from Japan, I've been doing a lot of my work.
So it was jet lag.
I've been doing a lot of my work at 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning. I'm all messed up because it does take you 2 days to get back there. But at the end of the day, there was nothing to self-report.
Sure. So
the city had already given all the information. And again, the point is there would have been no violation of ordinance or law, even if the city had paid for Margo's ticket. Right. I mean, this is now just gone. And I got several emails this morning that said, why are you wasting money spending?
Sure.
Money? And so it's just where somebody keeps telling lies over and over again and then threatening action, which is just an absurdity. And this is not an isolated incident. This is basically how the city of Bloomington operates almost on a daily basis.
So you and I have spent about 10 minutes now talking about this. We could be talking about something else. I don't know that we would be talking about it had you not sort of engaged or gotten involved. You have a playbook in trying to advance the city. It's what you ran on, and it's what got you elected. Wouldn't you be better served by us talking about the Transportation Commission or generating headlines about downtown? Or
absolutely.
Instead of giving others the opportunity to generate headlines.
Absolutely. And as I say, it's the couple of times where I have responded, it's involved not attacks on me, because I'm gutted like a fish every day.
When it involves
people that I care about, either my son or my partner, that's just so, and when this wasn't the first, this was over. Japan, frankly, so, the people in Japan 2 weeks ago, now 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I guess just now, were freaking out. Or 2.5 weeks ago,
but it
because
doesn't help.
because every single one of the sister cities. All of their finances were FOIA'd. And I said, that doesn't mean it's an investigation. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong. We've just got a group of people who, frankly, have nothing better to do than to try to poke through things and to try to find a gotcha thing here or there. And I guess that, you know, feeds their psychological needs.
But it sounds like you're admitting here that this doesn't really help you politically to engage.
No.
Okay. That's Mayor Terry Renner. This is Sound Ideas. Bloomington Normal's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. Let's talk about something substantive here.
Okay.
As mayor, downtown continues to be one of your priorities. Let's talk about your proposal for the city to essentially absorb the Downtown Bloomington Association.
Well, I don't know that that's my proposal. It's something that
it's
Obviously, I support just about anything that will improve downtown. This is one thing. The cost of it looks like it's going to be higher than we can afford right now. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't help. We could, for example, maybe bring DBA staff within City Hall so that at the very least for the next year, they don't have to pay rent. That could be an additional contribution. And it's, frankly, no skin off our backs or minimal cost to the taxpayer. So there are some things and there's some value to that. In the Town of Normal, that's the way it works.
Sure. And in a lot of cities.
Most any city that really has a successful downtown, you've got a team that's in place within your city government to make things happen and to provide services for your downtown business people and residents and to try to move projects forward in a proactive way.
So that's the change, possible change, and what would be gained?
Essentially, you have one-stop shopping. And within the city government, someone who has authority, rather than right now, Tricia does an outstanding job in many ways, of course, as director of DBA, but she's outside the city government.
So sometimes
it's difficult for her to figure out, who do I go to and how do I get this problem fixed?
So you don't think the city can actually afford this at this point? It might be something in the next budget cycle?
Well, that's what the council will make a determination on. The sticker shock on that, I think, was higher than people thought.
About $187,000, is that?
Additional. Right. And that's what we will see if we can afford that.
So
that determination has not been made. Last night was just pure discussion on a variety of fronts.
Sure. Yeah, the council didn't vote on this. How would it work if it moves forward? Would the DBA become part of the Community Development Department under Tom Daberiner?
Essentially. I mean, there are some other structural issues. They would continue to raise private funds. They would continue to, charge fees for the farmers market if they continue to operate that. There are any number of things. But essentially, that's what we're talking about, because community development should include our downtown.
And this wouldn't be at the expense of other parts or other business districts in the city?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, we're working very hard on trying to get, to revitalize Eastland Mall, all of our so-called underperforming properties in older neighborhoods, disproportionately older neighborhoods.
And we've heard many people during Sound Ideas, you and others, say a strong downtown benefits every ward.
Absolutely.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Mayor Terry Renner's in the studio. Let's talk about the job of mayor and your proposal for an assistant. How many hours do you put in to fulfill those duties on a weekly basis?
That varies tremendously. On the low side, there are probably a few weeks where I spend less than 40 hours a week as mayor. Mostly it's far more than that. And sometimes it's just because there are a wide variety of people who want answers.
So under 40 or above 40, but it's somewhere around 40.
It's always over. Well, I should say it's almost always over 40. But there are some times where if it's light, maybe 30, 35 hours, that would be the very, very low end. And so there's so many different tasks that the mayor's performing. And an administrative assistant, I was proposing. There were very few council members who were interested in supporting that. There were some who said maybe part-time or a compromise. And one thing that I did distribute last night is that, if we're not going down this path, it's important to have this discussion because it's just not real. We are, whether we like it or not, we are a metro city. And that comes with lots of media responsibilities. It comes with intergovernmental responsibilities. There are so many aspects to being mayor: economic development, citizen complaints, working and talking with city council members. So I had envisioned this really as a mayor council position.
So it's an assistant for the mayor and the council.
Absolutely. And in fact, I have a good friend who held this position in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who said that he had talked with council members far more than the mayor during the course of a typical week. Because you find, okay, what do you need to accomplish? And then you work to say with the different council members, okay, you've got this problem. Let's circle back with the mayor.
Sure.
So it's communication, it's time management, it's strategic scheduling, all of those things.
I just wonder if some people have a grasp of what your job as mayor is.
I mean, I think unless you're mayor,
they see you at a council meeting, and if they have to ask you something or deal with a problem, then they understand that part of it. But I suppose the duties of mayor run from the mundane all the way to going to the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Can you give me an example of something that ate up a lot more time than you thought it would actually eat up?
Sure.
A particular duty that, fell on your shoulders?
Well, initially it was trying to get department heads and others to do their jobs. And that has gone down dramatically, especially with the culture change that we've instituted, that you've got to be responsive to citizen concerns. Scott Black in particular spent all kinds of time, particularly in his ward. We have spent problems with code enforcement. Now we have an administrative court, so we can haul people in. If your property's in bad shape, usually it's absentee landlords, fix up your property or we will fine you, and you'll still have to fix up your property. So that was really intense, and now that's gone down. In fact, that's gone down quite dramatically. But people call me all the time, and that's fine. And for example, what I mean by strategic scheduling, if let's say we've got some sort of economic issue and there are seven business owners who want to talk to me, okay? Not unusual, and I'm just picking a number. Mm-hmm. It might be that three of those seven owners play nicely together and can be scheduled together, but that I need to talk to the first and the second before I get to talk to the group of three. And only somebody who understands the politics and the policymaking can really make that kind of strategic scheduling to make best use of the mayor's time.
More efficient.
To make it much more efficient. And, you can be a type A like I am and, try to answer questions and try to answer emails even in the middle of the night or try to do what's necessary. But in the long term, it's unsustainable because only an unusual person or a person like myself who also has a job where Illinois Wesleyan has been very helpful in stacking my classes and, working with me on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or somebody who's independently wealthy. Those are about the only people who are realistically going to be mayors.
Would this position be a political appointee? Would they serve the next mayor who may have vastly different political views than
you? Well, that's what my proposal was, to make what people call a political appointee. And all that means is that the next mayor isn't stuck with the person that I would hire.
Unless they want him or
unless
her.
They want him or her. That's absolutely right. And so I said, however you want to do this, I would recommend, my thought was I would recommend that the mayor be able to hire this one person, just like every single countywide elected official has at least one first assistant. And that's their guy or gal who handles things for them, who can be their spokesperson. And that's also part of the task. But much of it is dealing with policymaking and communication and strategic scheduling and dealing with intergovernmental players. We have 192 local governments in McLean County and taxing authorities. So there are, to some degree, I deal with the other intergovernmental groups, certainly District 87, I was there yesterday, Unit 5, Binward, Bloomington Normal Water Reclamation District. Sometimes small town mayors have issues that get in contact with me, other rural agencies and governments, Connect Transit, Bloomington Normal Association of Realtors. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. And I actually did have an alternative proposal to say, hey, if this is, you don't support this, I have a couple of possibilities. I'd be willing to talk about a part-time job, although I don't know how this person would do it part-time, frankly, if they need to tail me or they need to be my representative. I would be certainly willing to talk about that. Or, council members, there are a lot of places where elected officials need to be involved. So will you be my liaison? And I had a list of assignments. for liaison. For example, for Dave Sage, I asked for him to be the liaison to the Chamber of Commerce and be an advantage. Scott Black with the Bloomington Normal Realtors, et cetera. So I was trying to divvy up some of the tasks to step up to the plate.
Sure, to delegate some of those duties.
Of the duties, correct.
So where is council support? There wasn't strong support for the proposal. Why?
For
an assistant.
I think for two reasons. One is people were concerned about where we would get the money. The city manager had proposed that he had money that he could set aside. The salary as originally described to me was somewhere between $44,000 to $53,000. With benefits, it was going to be in the 60s. But when they made projections, they had to go to the top of the scale. And then if somebody joined and had a very big family, and so somehow they got into the $80,000 cost range. And I think some of the council members had sticker shock. I think some of it also is that some of the council members really don't understand what the mayor does on a daily basis, even some of the longer standing ones. Like I've been a department chair at Inland Westland on several occasions, overall for almost 20 years. But I don't really know what the president of Illinois Wesleyan does until I'm in that position.
I think it's fundraising.
That's what I
understand.
I'm just drawing the analogy. You're kind of close to it.
Yeah,
but
I'm joking. I understand your point. So what was the council's reaction to sort of delegating some of these duties to them? Did you get any reaction or feel for whether or not they would be willing to take on additional duties?
Nobody said that they would, which is interesting. I did get criticism from Alderman Sage, who said, well, why did you spring this on us? And I said, I'm not asking you to respond to this particular thing. This is the beginning of a conversation. And I did put that together yesterday afternoon as just an idea of, hey, this is another possibility. If you're mayor, you have to have a plan B and a C and a D and an E, as I've said. And this was probably plan C or D, but this is one option. And I wasn't asking anybody to necessarily respond specifically to this.
So it would have
been nice if someone had said, hey, you know, we understand we have full-time jobs, you have a full-time gig. We will step up to the plate. It would have been nice. And I think there are several aldermen, maybe most, who would be willing to do that.
So where do you go from here?
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to circle back with the council to see whether or not we have another public discussion of this, or do we focus only on one of the alternatives? If you're not interested in a mayoral aide, then is a part-time aide something on the table, or are you willing to step up to the plate and do more, and do more responsibilities as I had outlined in a memo that I distributed yesterday.
Okay. Terry Renner is the mayor of Bloomington. Thanks, as always, for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Great. Thank you.
Terry Renner is the mayor of Bloomington. The community's mayors join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, with doctors Brownstone, Crockett, Pinter, and Vise. Experienced physicians and staff dedicated to offering quality, personalized eye care. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy, and now a conversation about hot dogs, tweets, and selfies. The long-awaited Bloomington Normal Portillo's officially opens for business today after several days of sneak previews. Long lines are a guarantee, but just how much buzz is there? To find out, GLT's Ryan Denham sat down with Nate Carpenter from ISU's School of Communication. He runs the school's Social Media Analytics Command Center and took a closer look at how the new Portillo's measures up.
The prevailing view is that this is the most anticipated restaurant opening in Bloomington Normal history. And that's an impossible thing to measure, but what does the level of social media chatter tell us about just how big a deal this is? Can you put that in context for us?
That question about, you know, the most anticipated, like you said, is really hard to measure, but there are some ways that we can measure this. So first, I think by looking at some of the more popular pages that will be talking about this opening. So some of the places that I will go to look at are going to be Facebook pages like the Bloomington Normal Restaurant. restaurant scene. I'll go look at Portillo's page. I'll go look at campus, you know, Illinois State University campus pages, just to get a sense of you know, just the overall volume of activity related to that post. And so, in terms of you know, Portillo's, you know, the announcement of the restaurant opening, one of the things that I can do is go look at Portillo's page and just measure that against all of their other Facebook pages in terms of engagement. And one of the amazing things that we saw was that the announcement about a Bloomington Normal restaurant was the 10th most popular post in terms of engagement on their page ever. So it was a really big deal. And I think the only location that we saw that was bigger in terms of those kinds of announcements was a restaurant in Tampa Bay, Florida. So that was big. And when we think about, you know, magnitude, you know, in terms of you know, number of engagements or numbers of shares and things like that, I have a couple numbers here. We can look at 20,000 engagements. And so that is people on Facebook who are liking, commenting, reacting, sharing that post. And again, that was 20,000 just about the normal Portillo's announcement alone.
Portillo's is expanding across the area. It's opened in Champaign, Urbana already. There's rumors that it's opening soon in Peoria, too. How does our opening compare to what Portillo's has done in these other markets?
Champaign is probably the easiest to compare. I think we haven't seen a lot of chatter right now in Peoria. But if we look at the Champaign opening, we can compare at three levels. So I can look at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So if we look at, again, Portillo's Facebook page, the comparison is actually pretty stark. The Blono, Bloomington Normal opening was the 11th most engaging post on Portillo's official Facebook page. And I think Champagne's announcement was the 41st most engaging. And for comparison, I think they only had 9,000 engagements, whereas here it was 20,000 engagements. So almost, twice over in terms of the amount of engagement. So again, sharing and liking and commenting.
What about on Twitter and Instagram? What kind of chatter did we see in Champagne versus what we're seeing here locally?
Well, we're seeing similar comparison on Twitter to what we saw on Facebook. So if we look at Portillo's flagship Twitter account, what we saw was that on April 13, they posted that it's groundbreaking time in Normal. So it wasn't even the official announcement about Portillo's coming. It's just a groundbreaking announcement that received the most retweets and the most favorites of any tweet they had ever created, with 514 retweets and over 1,000 favorites. And the funny part is the second most retweeted and favorited post was the Champagne announcement. But we're looking at almost, again, a difference in terms of 100% difference. So in terms of Champagne, again, they posted groundbreaking time in Champagne, and that generated only 217 retweets and 657 favorites. So a big difference there in terms of, again, the levels of activity. And, you know, some of the theories that we have about that really are that, you know, Illinois State students are very active on Twitter, at least within the Bloomington Normal community. And so that activity generated a lot more interest. And in terms of Instagram, one of the ways that we can study that space is to look at people actually tagging locations. And right now, it's kind of neck and neck between Normal, Illinois, and Champaign. And so when we looked at their soft opening and the days in which they were giving out golden tickets, there were about 34 people who had tagged that location in that event. And in the Bloomington Normal location, we were looking at about 30. So it'll be very interesting to see what that will look like on Tuesday morning as people line up and wait in line and start tagging themselves and taking selfies while they're waiting for their experience with Portillo's.
I'm here with Nate Carpenter, Director of Convergent Media at Illinois State University's School of Communication. He also heads up the Social Media Analytics Command Center, or SMAC, here on campus in Fell Hall. So, Nate, a lot of people get their restaurant news from Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene, a very popular Facebook page that's run by Larry Carius, who used to work in food safety for the McLean County Health Department. So how does the new Portillo's stack up on that page compared to other restaurants that they've posted about?
If we do the same kind of comparison that I just talked about in terms of looking at the page and looking at the overall engagements, so again, the liking, the commenting, the other kinds of reactions and the sharing that go on, the Portillo's announcement, and actually any discussion of Portillo's, only reached, the top 20 or top 22, somewhere in that range. And again, what I think is happening is we have kind of two different worlds going on in terms of the restaurant scene. I think the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene is generally followed by people who have been here in the community for a while or those who are not affiliated with Illinois State's campus as much. And so what we saw there was that, again, it was in the top 20. Still quite a few engagements, about 900 engagements. But for perspective, Garcia's opening, Garcia's Pizza in Bloomington, generated more than 2,200 engagements. So again, more than double what we saw with Portillo's. And that was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago that restaurant opened. And then even bigger was the announcement that Beningo's was closing, and that was 3,400 engagements. Those were really up there in the top two, both Beningo's and Garcia's. So in terms of that world and that restaurant scene, this conversation isn't quite as engaging. It's not driving as much attention as we might see directly on Portillo's Facebook page, or else as we've seen in the larger Bloomington Normal Twitter community, which is largely dominated by Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan students.
So it's hot dogs, right? Who cares? But even this has generated a little bit of controversy. Some criticize the Normal Town Council for tax incentives that were offered to get Portillo's to build here locally. Can you put that level of noise in context? I mean, are lots of people voicing that concern or not so much?
Well, it's interesting because the volume was not necessarily where we might anticipate, again, a really controversial topic. But the kinds of people, again, influential people, business owners, people who do have a strong voice in the community were those who were commenting and posting. So, for example, looking at the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene, we saw about 400 comments directly related to Portillo's opening. And about 15 were really kind of concerned in expressing either disappointment or frustration with those decisions. And when we dig in and look at who those people are commenting, again, they are other restaurant owners, business owners, people who do have really legitimate concern, as well as taxpayers in the community. But the nature of hype is that, again, the focus is really on that which is already escalating and snowballing. And so much of the attention has been on where and when is it going to open? How can I get early access to the restaurant? More so than, again, the really serious and legitimate concerns.
That's Nate Carpenter, Director of Convergent Media at Illinois State University's School of Communication. He also heads up the Social Media Analytics Command Center, or SMAC, here on campus in Fell Hall. I'm Ryan Denham.
The new Portillo's will employ around 200 people as it opens today. This is Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. An ISU scholar has written a biography of a German emperor who lived nearly nine centuries ago. It's the first such English-language biography of Frederick Barbarossa in nearly 50 years. John Fried is an emeritus distinguished professor of history. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Fried says Barbarossa's importance stretches well into the present from his leadership of the Holy Roman Empire starting in the year 1152.
I think he's an important character in German history. Various German regimes, at least for the last 150 years, have appealed to him, obviously to justify all sorts of different kinds of systems, some more successfully or less successfully than others. He became a symbol of German national unity in the 19th century. He was invoked then by the Second Reich. Then
the Kaiser Wilhelm.
They were juxtaposed. Barbarossa means red beard.
He was blonde.
He was really a blonde. Yes, that's the great irony about it all. But from 1871 on, Kaiser Wilhelm I was referred to as Barba Blanca, white beard. And so they actually built statues of the two men, say equestrian statues opposite each other. It was then, of course, invoked by the Nazis, although the Nazis' attitude was ambivalent. There was a certain ambivalence, but this then culminates in apparently Hitler's personal decision to name the attack on the Soviet Union after Barbarossa. It seems to be his personal decision. We don't really know. And I think most Americans, if they have heard of Barbarossa at all, it is in the context of the attack on the Soviet Union. I tried that out over the years with my students. And at first, I'd draw a complete blank. And then I'd say, are there any World War II buffs? And, you know, you'd see the light bulbs go on, and they'd say, oh, wait a moment. Mm-hmm. And that would be the connection.
As you point out, 1930s and 40s, but also in the 1860s, he was a big cultural icon. What makes him susceptible to, as you write in your conclusion, that rarely has a historical figure been more misrepresented and his public persona more shaped by legends and momentary political needs? Why him?
Well, it was, I think, a kind of mythology and that developed around him. First of all, it's not very clear to me that there would have been any other ruler of the Middle Ages who would have suited their purposes. And I think you have to get to, a bigger 19th century cultural issue that goes far beyond Germany. And that bigger cultural issue is that you have nation-state building, in which you are trying to take countries that are not really very united, and you're trying to create, in some sense, a artificial unity. And you do this in part by in creating a common language. In many cases, people don't speak the same language. You teach them a certain common language in the schools, but you also create an almost mythical history, and you do it around figures. Perhaps Joan of Arc is the most obvious example in France. She makes a very good Republican symbol, a peasant girl who rises to save France. But she's also good for the Catholic opposition to the Republic, because after all, she ends up being a saint. So she cuts across all the boundaries. We do in the United States the same thing with George Washington. And you think about the myth about Washington's Parson Weems, you know, he could not tell a lie. The whole image, the great portrait painting, which is now in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it's a huge painting of him crossing the Delaware. Do we really think that he crossed the Delaware in December standing up in an open rowboat? I doubt that he was doing that.
Really foolhardy, if
yes,
so.
Yes, the spirit of Valley Forge. And in a sense, Barbarossa served that same sort of purpose of national unity in a way that no other figure could. It was partially because a myth had developed that he was sleeping in this mountain, or in this mountain. The mountain was the Kiefhäuser in Thuringia, which was also a crucial location because it just happened to be within a few miles of Wittenberg, Luther's hometown, or a place where Luther starts off the Reformation. So it had all of those associations. But it was also very close to Weimar, the symbol, of course, of German cultural supremacy. So it was that kind of thing.
That sleeping thing, though, is a Siegfried image. It's an Arthur image. It's a Joseph of Arimathea and the Holy Grail image, all wrapped up into one.
The sleeping image. And by the way, Wagner at one point, before speaking, went to the Nibelungenlied, actually thought of writing Barbarossa sleeping into his version of the Nibelungenlied.
Oh, wow.
That was actually a point when Wagner was doing it. Yeah, there was a sleeping. The story had actually originally been told about Frederick's grandson, Frederick II, that got confused, and it was the Grimm brothers. in talking about German folk stories who brought this then to the attention, this myth. And at the beginning of the 19th century...
We can blame them for a lot.
We can blame them for a lot. The Grimms brought this attention, and it came at it, I think they published it in 1815, which was a very fortuitous moment, in a sense, to get to your basic question. And that was, there had been an enormous amount of hopes in the aftermath of the French Revolution and the Germans then rising up in 1813 in the Wars of Liberation against French occupation, that Germany would finally be united. And instead, the Congress of Vienna left Germany divided into 39 states. And at that point, the myth develops. And it's a poet, Friedrich Rückert, who writes a famous poem about Barbarossa's awakening in 1817. He has him sleeping, and he will awaken when Germany is finally united. And when unification comes in 1871, that myth has been fulfilled, and Rickert's poem became a mandatory part of the school curriculum of every German school child after 1871. So you get, it serves that political purpose of nation building, creating from a country that had, you know, been multiple states, a common history, but around the one monarch in German history where you really could write such a story about.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Fried, an emeritus distinguished professor of history at Illinois State University, who's written the first biography of Friedrich Barbarossa in nearly half a century, as published in English. And what's important for Americans to know now about Barbarossa?
He is a major figure to understand what Germany is like. If he was invoked as a symbol of national unity, in many ways, what he really did was to lay the foundation, or help to lay the foundation, for, in fact, the political division of Germany, contrary, in a sense, to the myth. I mean, in a sense, what he seems to have understood, realized, or simply stumbled into was that, obviously, you couldn't have a united Germany. It's an enormously diverse country, certainly particularly in the 12th century. And he sort of essentially allows the princes, who are the great men of the kingdom, and who are, and that's part of the secret of his success, almost all of them, his close relatives, to essentially establish order in their own territories as long as they sort of recognize his superiority. And he maintains, in Germany at least, an enormously successful regime, peaceful. Most monarchs faced rebellion. That was almost to be accepted. Didn't occur. I mean, he manages to rule for 38 years without any particularly significant rebellion against his authority.
And part of the reason, you say, is because he didn't have a home territory of significance in Germany until very late in his reign.
That's exactly, yes.
And so he was accepted as sort of a neutral arbiter because he didn't have a geographic interest in preferring one set of his relatives over another.
That was part of it. Now, of course, it changes because of what is in many ways the disaster of his reign. I mean, he's busy fighting the Pope.
Foreign entanglements, yes.
Foreign entanglements. He gets to Rome. He installs his Pope, his anti-Pope in Rome, who crowns him. And the next day, the plague breaks out, probably dysentery. His army starts dying. Everybody,
this is a bad symbol.
This is a bad symbol, including him, sees this as the judgment of God. But the advantage of all of this was that a lot of his relatives died, and he ended up getting their land. And so, in a sense, what was a disaster, in some ways, turned out to his advantage. But it altered his relationship to the princes because he now had a personal stake in the system, and he also had sons. When he started his reign, he had no son. He had no children when he started his reign. But once you have, of course, children, you're out to see that they are provided for. So in many ways, the game changed. And by the end of his reign, it's a different kind of relationship to the great men of the kingdom.
And he's less powerful as a result.
And he's less powerful as a result.
Let's talk about his accession. He was, as you term it, an accidental emperor because he wasn't considered a likely candidate. He wasn't raised or educated the way that other top royals were. You write he's illiterate and was not taught Latin, so he had to rely on translators for most of his life. Why did he emerge from the second tier of the royals to get this diadem?
I think there was basically we now know a coup d'etat, which they did a very good job covering up. His uncle, who wrote the early history of his reign, did a pretty good job covering it up, and we've only slowly figured out what was going on. The rules for succession were not fixed. It was a strange mixture of hereditary succession. You had to be of royal blood, but there was an element of election. And if you look very, very carefully at successions in, say, the 12th century, it isn't necessarily the person who would succeed by modern rules. William the Conqueror in England is succeeded by his second son, not his first son. Richard Lionheart, who dies without heir, is succeeded by his brother rather than his nephew, who would have been king by modern rules of succession. So that was the situation. The situation at the death of his uncle, Conrad III, was that Conrad had left behind a son who was probably 7 or 8 years old. There was no rule against child succession. It had child kings before, but child kings pose problems because somebody has to rule on behalf of the child king. It tended to be the queen, but the queen was dead. So there was nobody, and the next person who would have been the regent would have been Frederick because he was the closest male relative to begin with. So I suspect in that moment when you have a child king, you had had really about 75 years of considerable political chaos. There must have been a decision that it was probably better for stability, et cetera, to select the guy who was going to be the ruler anyway. And the point was, the one man in the kingdom who was literally related to all the feuding princes. That was what made him, in a sense, different. He was everybody's relative. Now, his cousin, who was overlooked for the crown, taken care of. He was given his duchy, Frederick's old duchy, etc. All the people who had supported Frederick were duly rewarded for their support. So
it's a soft coup.
It was a soft coup. Everybody got something out of it all. Not totally. I mean, things had to be worked out. His one uncle had to be placated, but it was worked out. It's obviously a good deal of very successful politics. But the fact that he didn't know, as you mentioned, Latin, is a pretty good sign that nobody assumed that he would succeed. Because contrary to our notions about kings being illiterate, a boy who was expected to be king was literate. He knew Latin, and which meant that he had gotten the same education as a member of the clergy and therefore is different from any other member of the laity. He's different from his illiterate dukes because he, in a sense, has already received a clerical education. So he's thinking more along the lines of a member of the high aristocratic clergy than just an ordinary layman.
John Freed's book, Frederick Barbarossa, The Prince and the Myth, is published by Yale University Press. Hear more of Freed's interview about Frederick's fight with the Pope and the medieval mind at our website, wglt.org.
Celebrate the end of summer at a harvest festival that does it right. The Sweet Corn Blues Festival is Saturday and Sunday, August 26th and 27th in Uptown Normal. This family-friendly street festival features tons of fresh sweet corn straight from the field, all kinds of fun activities, plus great live blues. Stop by the GLT booth to say hi, and don't miss the Sweet Corn Blues Festival, Saturday and Sunday, August 26th and 27th in Uptown Normal. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT BLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Christian Piccolini spent 8 years of his life as a neo-Nazi. He left the lifestyle and started a nonprofit in Chicago called Life After Hate to help others leave hate groups. He spoke with IPR's Rachel Otwell back in February. We're revisiting that part of the conversation today in wake of the killing and unrest in Virginia.
What we're calling the alt-right these days is, in fact, what we called neo-Nazis back in the 80s and 90s. There's really no difference other than the packaging that it comes with. They've learned through our efforts many, many years ago that if they blend it in and they mainstream the ideology and just toned it down just a little bit to be slightly more palatable to the masses and focused on people who had an underlying grievance, that they would be able to infiltrate and convert more people onto the cause. And we're seeing that today. And certainly they're feeling a lot more emboldened because of our political climate. What was these smoldering little ashes and fires that were spread out all across the country on Election Day? It was as if a bucket of gasoline was kicked over onto these sparks and suddenly ignited a large-scale fire. And that's something that we're battling today. And we're seeing evidence that, you know, while they may have put down the swastika flags, the rhetoric is the same, the ideology is the same, and the mission of really creating a white homeland and expelling anybody who isn't what they would consider a white European out of the country, that is their ultimate goal.
Fake news is something Breitbart has been known to spread. Piccolini says fake news was around when he became a neo-Nazi in the late 80s.
Even before the internet came along, I mean, we were handed flyers and leaflets, and we spread the false propaganda and fake news by word of mouth. It was very face-to-face at that time. And also through our music, you know, we had a lot of platforms that had the same effect as what the internet is doing now for fake news. I think what the internet is doing now with news agencies like Breitbart and a lot of these other fake news websites is that because there's so much information online, it's become so hard to distinguish what's real and what's fake, what's propaganda and what's parody. And they've really keyed in on the fact that there are millions of young people who may feel socially awkward or on the fringes of society who are sitting behind computer screens all around the world. What I call the rabbit hole effect of kind of what we see on websites like Amazon, where you buy a product and it recommends another product that you like. Well, a lot of those same algorithms exist on social media. So if you begin by clicking on some of these fake news sites, well, you're going to be fed those same stories over and over and over, and you go down a rabbit hole that's very hard to get out of and get a differing perspective from. So it's a very dangerous situation. And there are many young people who are disenfranchised with politics and with politicians, with law enforcement, who are really ambitious and looking to change the world. And once they stumble onto these facts, it's very difficult to understand that they're not true facts or that they're inflated or that they're completely skewed, such as black on white crime statistics, which somebody like Dylann Roof saw, and it encouraged him to go out and commit a horrific act of multiple murder. So it's a very dangerous situation where we've got to be able to discern what is credible and reputable news versus what is propaganda and fake news. But it's happened for decades. The platform has changed, and it's something that we need to stay on top of and identify as a problem.
Christian Piccolini, he was once a white supremacist, but is now a peace advocate, public speaker, and author. You hear Sound Ideas weekdays at noon and 6 p.m. on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or the individual interviews you heard today. Let us know what you think of this show. Go to WGLT.org to contact us or share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT 89.1 FM, Bloomington Normal's public media.